Good evening and welcome to tonight's accredited education program, Improving Care Disparities for Black Americans in Mississippi with Venous Thromboembolism. My name is Charlie Pollack. I am a clinician scientist in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Mississippi School of Medicine in Jackson. And I've been working in the thrombosis area for longer than I care to remember. We're going to highlight tonight some of the important issues around thrombosis and antithrombotics, particularly as they affect underserved populations within the state of Mississippi. And I'm very honored to have as co-faculty tonight the three individuals, very eminent individuals, really know this stuff, who are joining me tonight. I'll let them introduce themselves, starting with Dr. Hadley.
Good evening. I'm Dr. DeGale Hadley. I'm board-certified family medicine physician, and I am founder and chief executive officer of Dynamic Wellness Medical Clinic in Cleveland, Mississippi. Day-to-day family medicine doctor, treating a variety of different illnesses, including VTE, on a daily basis. And I'm happy to be on board today.
Good evening. I'm Elizabeth Hood. I'm a pharmacist at the University of Mississippi Medical Center in Jackson. We have a large anticoagulation service there, where we manage patients in the hospital as well as outpatient. And we have a lot of patients from around Mississippi that we manage. So I'm happy to be able to join you tonight to share some experience.
Hi, my name is Cynthia Harrington. I'm a family nurse practitioner in a family medicine clinic in Louisville, Mississippi. I also practice in a hospital ER as well. And I'm happy to be with you.
So now that you've met our faculty, I'd like to start by briefly introducing you to this comprehensive series of educational activities that we're kicking off tonight. This initiative has been designed with the help of several collaborators who are identified on this slide, and we'd like to thank them for their contributions and their dedication to improving the lives of our patients in Mississippi and elsewhere. This education stems from the need to impact care and management of Black Americans in Mississippi with VTE, venous thromboembolism, and most importantly, to identify barriers and work towards improvement, not only in their treatment, but also address the challenges that sometimes occur during the transition from the hospital back to the community. We hope to continue to work closely with our collaborators, the community, and the critical access hospitals that are involved in this to further understand and ultimately help meet these challenges. The first goal of our initiative is what we're doing this evening, which is providing education. We'll be providing 5 live activities targeting care providers in the Mississippi region. So now let's continue with tonight's activity and begin by discussing why we chose Mississippi to launch this initiative. So why Mississippi? It's no surprise, unfortunately, that healthcare outcomes in Mississippi and in fact across the Deep South are not as good as they are in other parts of the country. And much of that is due to the comorbidity burden that they bear in multiple different disease states. But many of those comorbidities put them at greater risk both for initial venous thromboembolism. And let's be sure we understand that includes DVT and pulmonary embolism, right? And some people even include post-thrombotic or post-phlebitic syndrome in the VTE sphere and pulmonary embolism. So there's initial VTE. Doesn't have to be DVT leading to PE. Sometimes people just present with a PE with no known preceding DVT. And then recurrent disease with either DVT or PE. Mississippi ranks last, or close to last, in almost every leading health outcome. Evaluated within the context of National Reported Critical Access Hospital data on care transition, unfortunately, our critical access hospitals, which do so much for the patients in Mississippi, still rank low. So collectively, if you look at this information as objectively as we all can, working in the middle of it, there's clearly a pressing need for better education of clinicians. And you see physicians, nurses, pharmacists here on the speaker panel tonight. Hopefully we've got all the professions represented in our audience tonight. Providing support tools, making people aware of resources that are aligned with hospital QI initiatives. And really give the critical access hospitals and the very skilled and dedicated clinicians that work within them the tools they need to improve these outcomes. And we think that we can really impact clinician practices, hospital policies, and then care transitions, particularly among these underserved Black Americans who are discharged home on oral anticoagulant therapy. So these dots all represent critical access hospitals. in the state of Mississippi, and they have a primary role in the care of rural black patients. In fact, in Mississippi, nearly a quarter of blacks are considered rural, and they constitute more than a third of the rural population in the state. I mentioned a moment ago, I'll be more explicit here, critical access hospitals underperform compared with their urban counterparts. Even when, you know, urban in the state of Mississippi isn't urban like we talk about in New York or New Jersey or Illinois. But even with compared to urban counterparts within the state, in Jackson, in Tupelo, in Hattiesburg, particularly in care transition and post-hospitalization care. Nearly half of rural hospitals in Mississippi are at risk for potential closure. Whether or not the new infrastructure funding activities may help with that, we don't know. We've got to assume that we've got to do the best we can with what we got. And as I mentioned before, unfortunately, it's worth mentioning again, Mississippi ranks last or close to last on basically all health care measures. And black Americans within the Mississippi population, within the Mississippi minorities, are disproportionately impacted by these poor health outcomes. So if we were to start losing some of those hospitals, that would only make this problem worse. So what about the effects of race? I've made it a point now to say that, you know, not just rural populations, but rural black populations are at higher risk for these bad outcomes. Well, I spoke earlier about what VTE is. It's this continuum of disease, DVT, PE, and I spoke about post-thrombotic syndrome, again, also sometimes called post-phlebitic syndrome. There's a special type of pulmonary hypertension called CTEPH. One of those times when the abbreviation actually helps a lot, because that's easier than saying chronic thromboembolic pulmonary hypertension, which is a sequelae of repeated PEs, often most of which are very small and by themselves don't do any damage. But over time, they start to create this pulmonary hypertension, which can be really disabling for patients. DVT is usually the start, but again, it doesn't have to start at DVT. Patients can present, you know, first to blush with a PE, just like someone with coronary artery disease may not start with unstable angina and then go on to end-STEMI and then have a STEMI. Sometimes they come in with the tombstone ST elevation the first time they have chest pain. DVT, when it happens, typically starts in the lower extremities. It does happen in the upper extremities, and there's no diminution in the risk of those clots embolizing if they form in the upper extremity, or in the pelvis. The pelvis is really problematic for us because ultrasounds don't really pick them up well there. Classically, DVT produces pain and distal edema. And it can either propagate, meaning the clot goes up proximally towards the heart, or it can embolize. And in fact, every DVT embolizes. If you've got a DVT, there are always little microemboli flipping off and going north to the lungs, but generally they're small enough that they don't cause symptoms or pulmonary injury. It's only when a big piece breaks off, and it may actually be the entire clot that breaks off and goes north, that we have a PE. So if we look at this continuum of disease of VT, it actually kills more Americans each year than, get this, breast cancer, HIV/AIDS, and motor vehicle accidents combined. So this is a real public health problem by any measure. And I'm an emergency physician. I'm biased, but I will tell you that except when it occurs on the inpatient ward, most VTE presents to the emergency department. Now, why is that important? Because we better not miss it. You know, we can't say, well, I think it's just a muscle strain, or I think he's got a Baker cyst behind his knee. We got to be sure that we know whether or not the patient has a DVT so that we can initiate treatment. Because remember, any DVT can embolize and create a potentially fatal pulmonary embolism. So we all recognize in the public health world, as well as in clinical practice, that we're seeing more cases of VTE than we've ever seen before. So why is that? It's really not hard to understand. If we look at the risk factors of VTE, they're all going up, okay? VTE increases with increasing age. Well, the fastest growing demographic in the U.S. population right now is patients over the age of 75. Obesity is an independent predictor of VTE risk. Well, you may have noticed, no matter where you practice, but particularly if you're in Mississippi, obesity is a real problem. The incidence has never been higher. People talk about an epidemic of obesity. It's a problem, and in addition to all the other cardiometabolic stresses and sometimes economic stresses that morbid obesity puts on patients, it also significantly increases their risk of VTE. Cancer is a very common comorbidity among patients with VTE, and in fact, sometimes it goes the other way around. Sometimes cancer is discovered because a patient develops a DVT and we don't know why. And the cancer is figured out once the workup for the DVT or the PE goes along. Cancer is, you know, more successfully treated now than it has been in the past, but what that means is these patients have a longer lifespan at risk for developing cancer-related VTE. Heart failure. Oh my gosh, we got more drugs and procedures to treat heart failure than we've ever had before. But patients with heart failure, even if they're doing pretty well, they're functioning at a pretty high level, they're still at continuing risk for VTE. And so that's going up. And then there are many other chronic illnesses and disabilities. Think about COPD, for example, that patients are being treated more successfully, they have a longer lifespan, and for that entire lifespan, they're at risk of VTE. So if you think about that within your patient population, that's important to understand who might be experiencing a DVT in the face of, you know, sort of nonspecific symptoms. And also it helps us identify patients who would likely benefit from thromboprophylaxis, either around a surgery or around an acute care medical hospitalization. The impact of VT is pretty easy to quantify. High mortality rate if the patient has a PE. It's certainly one of the most common causes of death among hospitalized patients. Probably one of the most, if not the most common cause of death in patients who die outside the hospital and never have an autopsy, so we don't know for sure what caused it. Each year, venous thromboembolism affects about 1 million people, and somewhere between 60,000 and 100,000 die of PE. It says DVT/PE. You know, you don't really die of DVT, but DVT is often the source of PE. And sudden death is the first symptom of PE in 25% of patients. So you're behind the eight ball in at least one out of four patients when they have that disease. And there are also genetic risk factors, things like factor 5 Leiden, hyperhomocysteinuria. These people are at increased risk genetically determined for VTE. And somewhere between 1 in 20 and 1 in 10 Americans have at least one of those risk factors. So this thing's here to stay. It's going to be with us. We need to be sure we identify it, diagnose it definitively, and then treat it appropriately. So the burden of disease, when death occurs, it occurs typically fairly early, within a month of the diagnosis, and that's because PE, again, is a pretty effective killer. Those patients who don't die, even if they just have a simple DVT, often experience long-term complications. Up to a half of them, for example, will develop, particularly depending on what age they have the DVT, post-phlebitic or post-thrombotic syndromes. We think about 25% of calf DVTs will progress up to a proximal DVT. We define proximal, I'm not going to hold my leg up here, but we define proximal as the popliteal vein or higher. So popliteal, femoral, iliac, at least a quarter of those will progress, even if when they're first diagnosed, they're below the knee, and that's why serial ultrasounds are important. And again, up to half of these patients will develop long-term complications. We think once you get proximal, once you get above the popliteal, and I say we think because, of course, we can't track every single patient who has a proximal DVT, but we think about half of those will embolize. Now, not all of those create a very dramatic presentation where somebody comes in, you know, sudden death or cardiac arrest or needing to go to the ICU and immediately get thrombolysis, but still, they'll have a definable PE. PE, I mentioned on the last slide, the leading preventable cause of death in hospitalized patients. Again, up to a quarter of them present a sudden death, and without treatment, which, you know, hopefully is never going to be the case, but unfortunately, there's malpractice history to prove that it is sometimes the case. About 30% of patients with PE will die, but adequate treatment reduces mortality down to the single digits. So again, very important, no matter where you work, small critical access hospital, a clinic, or a great big urban center, you gotta recognize PE. It's a masquerader of sorts. It can look like heart failure, it can look like COPD, it can look like pneumonia, it can look like an MI. You got to identify it, because if you treat it, you can really save people a lot of long-term morbidity and potentially short-term mortality. So there are issues around the social determinants of health. I've sort of alluded to some of them, where the Black Americans, of whom we're primarily speaking tonight, may have more issues with this disease. But I want Beth to take this slide and run with that a little bit.
Thank you. When we talk about social determinants of health, these are conditions in the environments where people are born and where they live and work and play and go to school that affect their health and functioning and quality of life and different risks that they're exposed to. These can be grouped into five domains according to Healthy People 2030. And when we look to have positive outcomes with our VTE patients in Mississippi, we have to understand that all of these domains plays a role for our patients. When we look at economic stability, 1 in 10 people in the United States live in poverty. In Mississippi, that's 20% of our population live in poverty. And these patients are just not able to afford healthy food, their medications, doctor's appointments. When you look at education access and quality, particularly in rural Mississippi, patients have less access to quality education, whether in high school or community college or colleges, and they have less access also to job opportunities where they might could get private health insurance. With healthcare access and quality, 13% of people in Mississippi have no insurance, and they are unable to get preventative healthcare services. A lot of them are unable to pay for medications to treat their chronic diseases. And even some of our patients that have private insurance or even Medicare often cannot afford to pay their co-pays to see their doctor, or they can't find a qualified physician in their area that their insurance will cover. When you think about the neighborhood and built environments, a lot of our patients don't have transportation. And this is a big problem, especially in rural Mississippi, when patients don't have cars or not even a public transportation for them to come to clinic or to the hospital when they're sick. So this is a big problem in Mississippi. Also, when you think about social and community contacts, this is when we're speaking of health literacy. And in Mississippi, we have a lot of patients that have low health literacy. These patients require a lot more time to educate them so that they understand the importance of their medication. They understand why they need to take the medicines to treat their VTE in this situation, and when to follow up with their physician. So it requires you understanding your patient in all of these aspects if we're gonna have a good, successful treatment of our patients with VTE in Mississippi. I wanna introduce Leslie Lake of the National Blood Clot Alliance. She is a PE survivor and also a patient advocate. So we're gonna hear from her today.
Hi, my name is Leslie Lake and I am a pulmonary embolism survivor. So what happened to me? In June of 2018, I was walking back to my apartment. All of a sudden, I had a really hard time breathing, going up a slight incline, and thought I was having a heart attack. I managed to make my way back to my apartment, holding on to the side of buildings, and called my doctor's office, who had just retired, and was told that I couldn't come into their office because I would be considered to be a new patient. Long story short, I ended up in the emergency room. I really didn't want to go to the emergency room. That led me to a place called the National Blood Clot Alliance. The National Blood Clot Alliance is the only patient advocacy group in the United States focused purely on blood clots, so DVTs and PEs, and it's an online facility for patients to get information. The information was so good that I ended up actually joining the board, and I'm now chairman of the board of the National Blood Clot Alliance. Anyway, as the research continued, I started to learn that women and African Americans in particular were at much higher risk of blood clots, as high as 30 to 60% higher for African Americans than Caucasians. You know, is it because they're not treated the same? Is it because they have a higher incidence level? There are a lot of unknowns. The same thing with women. Women tend to get treated differently. I was treated differently. I was having a hard time breathing. I couldn't breathe, but yet they insisted upon doing 3 gynecological exams on me. And if you're an African-American woman and you're pregnant, it is one of the leading causes of maternal death for women, a pulmonary embolism. And so much of this can actually be controlled in a hospital setting. So we know that there's a tremendous level of disparities between who gets treated, how they get treated, and their outcomes over a certain amount of time.
Racial disparities and incidence of VTE. The incidence of VTE, including DVT and PE, is 30 to 60% higher for blacks than whites. The sickle cell trait associated with the increased risk of VTE, and up to 88% of black Americans carry the sickle cell trait. Idiopathic VTE, especially idiopathic PE, is higher among blacks with 18% versus 10%. Pregnancy rate related VTE rates are also higher in African American patients as well. 30-day mortality is 30% higher for African Americans, and blacks who passed away from VTE were typically 9 years younger than whites. The incidence of outpatient or out of hospital fatal PE was 3 times higher for blacks than whites. Significantly higher incidence of VTE in blacks in rural Southeast than in blacks in the rest of the country. Something not seen among our white counterparts. So this graph shows the VTE risk of mortality by race and risk class. And as you can see, in African Americans, the 30-day mortality rate is much higher than our counterparts. Some barriers to better healthcare in the Black Mississippi population. The first area is distrust of the medical profession. A lot of African Americans in our area don't trust doctors, and they don't trust the healthcare establishment just because of past experiences. And that's something we've been actively working to alleviate in Mississippi. Lack of health insurance. And there's a couple of different reasons for this. It may be related to a higher cost of insurance, which is as high as 20% of the average household income. Lack of Medicaid expansion and other subsidized programs in the state of Mississippi. Some coverage gaps. And this means a person who earns too much money to qualify for traditional Medicare or Medicaid programs. But they also don't earn enough money to qualify for premium tax credits under the marketplace plans. And most states that have not expanded Medicaid are in the South, and Mississippi is one of them. Blacks in Mississippi have the highest mortality rate for cardiovascular disease, diabetes, renal disease, and also cancer. And nationwide, blacks are less likely to receive a full course of anticoagulation after VTE or direct acting anticoagulants than other race and ethnic groups. And the odd ratio is 0.86. Barriers to healthcare in Mississippi and black patients. Also, poverty plays an instrumental role in the barriers that are placed in front of African Americans as far as access to healthcare. Food insecurities, lack of safe and affordable housing, inadequacies in education, the lack of access to healthcare providers in their area, lack of transportation and transportation infrastructures, and also racial bias. COVID-19, the increased risk of VTE. VTE incidence among patients hospitalized with COVID-19 run as high as 7.7% to 17%. And severe COVID-19 induces a prothrombotic state. African Americans are 2.9% more likely to be hospitalized with COVID-19 and 1.9 times more likely to die. Healthcare disparities and socioeconomic status may play a role in this. Black patients are less likely to be prescribed anticoagulants, and when prescribed, tend to spend less time within the therapeutic range for warfarin therapy. Despite increases in prescriptions of DOACs in the U.S., overall, Black Americans are less likely to receive them, even when controlling for the socioeconomic variables. Black patients underrepresented in clinical trials, 0.4% of the clinical trial population for many of these anticoagulants have been Black. Mechanism action of thrombosis formation in COVID-19. It is multifactorial. It's believed to be stimulated by endothelial injury caused by SARS COVID-19 infection. It leads to micro and macro thrombosis. We all know about Virchow's triad, which includes injury to the endothelial of the vasculature. These all play a important role in thrombus formation. Vasoendothelial dysfunction, loss of anticoagulant properties associated with the increase in von Willebrand's factor, factor 8, angiopoietin 2, increased fibrinogen, and the presence of antiphospholipid antibodies and dysregulated inflammation all play an important role. African Americans may have a higher risk secondary to the fact that we have higher circulating levels of von der Willebrand's factor, factor 8, and also fibrinogen. Factors that increase the risk of hospitalization. There was a study completed in the Louisiana health system between March the 1st, 2020, and April the 11th, 2020, in which 3,481 patients who tested positive for COVID were included in the study. Approximately 76.9% of those patients were hospitalized with COVID-19, and 70.6% of those who died were Black. Whereas Blacks comprise almost 31% of the Oscar Health population. This demonstrated the following factors that affected the rate of COVID hospitalizations. Race, increasing age, higher score on the comorbidity index, public insurance, which is Medicare versus Medicaid, and residents in a low income area and obesity, all were factors in increased risk of hospitalizations with COVID-19. We now have an interactive VTE case study. Ms. CJ is a 46-year-old African-American female who presented to a local emergency department with a chief complaint of having shortness of breath for the last 2 days. Subjectively, she states that she has not been able to ambulate much. When she walks for short distances, she feels as if she's going to pass out. She also reports having a fever, chills, nausea and vomiting, and some diarrhea. The patient states that she has been exposed to some relatives who recently have been infected with COVID-19. Her past medical history includes hypertension, diabetes mellitus, morbid obesity, diabetic nephropathy. She has a history of having a CVA within the last 2 years, hyperlipidemia, anemia. Her social history, she is currently disabled and she lives on a fixed income. She does not smoke, drink, or use any illicit drugs. She has no known allergies at the present. Her family history is positive for blood clots on her mother's side. Upon arrival to the local emergency room, she was seen and evaluated, and subsequently it was noted that she had an elevated LDH of 734, a CKMB that was normal at 0.22, and a troponin that was also normal at 0.012. Her D-dimer was largely abnormal with a value of 5,898. Her hemoglobin was 6.2, and she had a rapid COVID test that was positive. Because of her D-dimer being elevated, a CTA of the chest was obtained, and the CTA revealed right middle lobe and right lower lobe emboli. Ground glass consolidations considered consistent with COVID pneumonia and possible pulmonary infarct. This patient was subsequently transferred to a tertiary facility for further management of her condition. Now we will have Charlie, who will lead us into some discussion of this case.
Thank you, DeGale. That's a great case. And I just, before we go into these questions, I just want to point out a couple of things of interest. This is a particularly sobering slide, and I just want to call your attention to it again. This is from Ochsner, you know, a storied healthcare facility in the state of Louisiana. And these numbers are just staggering. 77% of the patients who were hospitalized with COVID-19 and 71% of those who died were Black. But if you look at the catchment area of Ochsner, which is large across Louisiana, only 31% of them were Black. So, you know, we've got to have our antenna up, our clinical antenna, if you will, for recognizing that these underserved minorities are at greater risk of bad things happening to them. And it's disproportionate to how often they present at the hospital. I also want to point out in Mrs. CJ's history here, she's got morbid obesity. That's the main VTE risk factor that shows up here. But you know, her history is pretty suggestive. Now, the problem is in COVID times, you can say, well, this is probably just COVID pneumonia. Okay, you got to think about the fact that she could have in this thromboinflammatory disease that we call COVID-19, she could have clot in addition to COVID pneumonia. And the workup is certainly suggestive of that. Now, I think probably most of you on the call recognize that an elevated D-dimer is nonspecific, but that's as Dr. Hadley said, that's a pretty significantly elevated D-dimer. That really should raise your concern for a venous thromboembolic event. And fortunately, she had a chest CTA done. She did, in fact, have a COVID pneumonia. That ground glass consolidation, I speak from experience. I had a bilateral COVID pneumonia. I still have ground glass consolidation in both the lower lungs. But more importantly, that angiogram showed that she had a right middle and right lower lobe embolus. And fortunately, she was transferred to a tertiary care facility. So let's assume that we've gotten her to the point with her, you know, very significant PE that she's now ready for oral therapy. You know, it used to be that the oral therapy, in fact, the only oral therapy we had for patients with PE once they were ready to be off of parenteral drugs was warfarin. And of course, by the time they were ready for oral therapy, they had been bridged with heparin or low molecular heparin. But now we have these DOACs available. And there are four of them that are approved by the FDA. We're going to talk more about these later. For the treatment of venous thromboembolism, two of them can be used directly without any sort of heparin or low molecular heparin lead-in. The other two do require lead-in, which this patient would have had. So how do you make a choice? Well, you think about drug-drug interactions. The DOACs don't really have much in the way of drug-drug interactions. You think about dosing. You know, they're for the most part twice a day, with the exception of edoxaban, which is once a day. What really comes down to, in underserved populations who tend to be underinsured at a critical access hospital, is what can they pay for? What can we get coverage for through the social worker or case manager? Who's going to have the best indigent patient support program? So there's no one answer to this question. It's going to depend on what hospital you're at, what county you're at, whether or not the patient has insurance. DeGale, you see patients like this, unfortunately, with some regularity. What are some of the ways you make a decision on which DOAC to use if, in fact, you're not going to put the patient on warfarin, which I wouldn't do? I would much rather than be on a DOAC. How do you approach this?
Well, we approach it by looking at what resources we have that we can assist this patient. We look at the insurance to see, like, say, for instance, they're on Medicaid. We look at the Medicaid formulary list to see which ones are available to the patient. And that is the main lead into which ones we place the patient on. We also look at the compliance of the patient. Sometimes patients who may be on warfarin may be lost to contact when they have to come in and get PTINRs and things of that nature. Does this patient have transportation to go into a lab and get a PTINR? Do they have the financial resources to be able to afford this if they don't have insurance? So those are some of the things we look at when we look at what DOACs what anticoagulants we place the patient on. And it's really based on that particular patient and it's catered toward that particular patient and what their needs might be at that particular time.
So let's move on to diagnosis and treatment. This is something that we're going to run through fairly quickly, but it's sort of foundational information that I think everybody needs to get a refresher on every now and then. Really critical that we make that diagnosis early and accurately. And this is one of those areas where there's a broad differential diagnosis. So a patient with a swollen leg or a patient with shortness of breath, I mean, think about all the differential considerations that come into play with those two chief complaints. So you have to take this concept of pretest probability That is, do I think this patient may actually be at risk of having a DVT? Well, we talked about the risk factors. If they're obese, if they're pregnant, if they have cancer, if they have heart failure, maybe if they have COPD, that increases their risk, which means it increases their pretest probability, makes you more likely to check that D-dimer, maybe more likely to order an ultrasound. Likewise, more likely to get a CT scan if they're short of breath. So the diagnostic testing can be lengthy, it can be expensive. We can't afford to do CAT scans when everybody comes in with shortness of breath. So we need to think about pretest probability and decide who's most likely to benefit from further testing than just a clinical evaluation. So here's this concept, PTP, pretest probability. And there's a lot of work, much of it has been done, the reference here is from Lynn Ortel, but much of the pretest probability work has been done by a guy up in Canada named Phil Wells, and I'm sure many of you have heard about the Wells score. There's a Wells score for DVT, there's a Wells score for PE, we'll talk about that in a minute. But basically, you as a clinician, doesn't matter whether you're a nurse or a nurse practitioner or a PA or a physician, if the population you're seeing has a low prevalence of PE, then you're likely to approach that patient with a low pretest probability. So you got somebody who's not obese, who doesn't have cancer, who doesn't have chronic disease, who's never had a family history of a clot. I mean, that's a low pretest probability. And anything, you know, each one of the risk factors that layers in on top of that starts to increase your risk, and somewhere there's a line between intermediate and high pretest probability that is really going to be in your own mind as the provider, and you're going to develop your own sense for that. As I'm going to show you, there's some mathematical models that help with that. Keep in mind that the prevalence of VT within a population influences the predictive value of diagnostic test. So again, a very low pretest probability patient, you're unlikely to get a diagnostic test to help you predict that the patient actually has DVT or PE. So I spoke about Phil Wells. These are the Wells criteria for DVT. I'm not going to go through the scoring system. You see it there on the slide. But, I mean, you recognize the risk factors. Active cancer, we talked about. Bedridden, either from illness or major surgery or trauma. The entire leg is swollen as opposed to just part of the leg. Pitting edema that's asymmetric. Okay, that's a red flag in terms of DVT. Previous DVT, really important. And I didn't point that out on DeGale's case earlier, but that patient did have a family history of DVT in the past. If a patient has a personal history of DVT or PE, then that patient, regardless of anything else, carries a 15 to 30 times relative risk higher than a patient who hasn't had a DVT or PE in the past of having another one. So a really important piece of the history to elicit, assessing and potentially diagnosing or at least raising the suspicion of PE. And you see that the first one is clinical signs and symptoms of DVT. I mean, if a patient looks like he has a DVT, then obviously his or her risk of having a PE is that much higher. Likewise, if the patient has an alternative diagnosis that's less likely than PE, that's important towards making you think more about PE. If the patient's tachycardia, if the patient's coughing up blood, if the patient's got malignancy. These are all things that contribute, again, to the probability score that you're going to see in this case for PE. So in the initial study that Wells did, you see the date here, 1997, my gosh, that's 25 years ago. What he found in his with his system of dividing people into low, moderate, and high pretest probabilities, look how predictive his score was. So if the patient with low probability, actually only 3% of them turned out to have DVT. If the patient was high pretest probability, 75% turned out to have DVT. So the ultrasound's helpful, but man, that's pretty accurate right there just with clinical evaluation. And they did serial ultrasonography in all of these patients. They did contrast venography in a lot of these patients. You don't do that in clinical practice. It's part of a clinical trial. But generally speaking, if they were low probability, then over the course of 3 months, only 0.6%, 6 out of 1,000, actually turned out to have a DVT. So this is pretty highly predictive. This is a kind of a flow chart here of how to manage your clinical suspicion of pulmonary embolism. And look at that first, I think maybe you can see my mouse here. Look at that first branch point. It's your pretest probability. Okay, if you think the patient probably doesn't have a PE, then get a D-dimer. If you think they probably do have a PE, don't even bother getting a D-dimer. go straight to some sort of imaging study and maybe even think about initiating therapy. Often in that case, it's going to be with a parenteral agent first. But a D-dimer can help separate out some of the low probability patients. You don't have to work with them anymore. If the chest radiography is abnormal, then you should go straight to CT. If it's normal, doesn't mean the patient doesn't have a PE. You still might consider doing a VQ scan or a chest CT depending on what you have in your institution and how sick the patient is. But again, PE is a potentially mortal diagnosis. DVT is a morbid diagnosis. PE is a potentially mortal diagnosis. So if you're really thinking the patient may have PE, go ahead and initiate treatment. You can always pull it back. A lot easier to not give that next dose of low molecular heparin or turn off that heparin drip than it is to say, boy, I wish I had started this a half an hour ago before now I've got to give them a thrombolytic. So this is just incorporating the well score into the diagnostic algorithm. Here again, differentiating with D-dimer for low probability or intermediate probability patients and straight to CT for high score patients. And once you suspect or confirm pulmonary embolism, go ahead and treat it. Once it is diagnosed, then there's a minority of patients who need thrombolytic therapy. Unfortunately, there's some in whom it's contraindicated, like some who've had recent surgery or had a stroke in the past, then those patients may need surgical embolectomy. Surgical embolectomy is a nasty procedure and it's got a high mortality. So hopefully you're not going to see many of these patients anyway, but if you do, you're going to be able to manage them with resuscitative measures and then lytic therapy if it's needed. So I'm going to go back to DJ, who introduced us to our COVID positive patient earlier, who was confirmed to have a PE, remember, right middle and lower lobe, and he's going to take us through the rest of the course here.
Thanks, Charlie. So this patient was evaluated for possible catheter-directed thrombolysis. She was transferred to a tertiary facility. The facility that she was initially seen, triaged at did not have that capability. It was determined that she was not a candidate for such therapy, and because of her anemia, which created another dynamic in this case, she received 2 units of blood via transfusion. She was started on the heparin drip and she subsequently was transitioned to a apixaban after catheter-directed thrombolysis was deferred. The capability of pulmonology coming in and doing a consult on her was initiated, and this patient was discharged on the second day.
Yeah, so credit to the team that managed her there. I mean, this is a pretty sick patient coming in. Remember, she's got COVID pneumonia in addition to her PE. So they managed her well. They got her out. Very important question here that comes up in the discussion points. Why did DJ make such a point to say that she was anemic and that she ended up being transfused? Well, because as I said a little bit ago, you cannot put a patient on an anticoagulant, any anticoagulant for that matter, any antiplatelet agent, without having to give that patient some increased risk of bleeding. So if you wonder why this lady may have anemia, well, you know, she's got a number of chronic diseases, maybe it's just that. But what if she's got a low-grade carcinoma in her colon and it's just sort of oozing blood from day to day, and over months and maybe even a couple of years, this tumor is very slow growing and she hasn't really, you know, bled out or even noticed the melanoma that she might be having. Well, you put that patient on an anticoagulant and suddenly that drip is gonna become stronger and more active, and she may get into a lot of trouble. So we do worry about patients who are anemic, and in fact, in both VTE studies and in acute coronary syndrome studies, patients who initiate antithrombotic therapy when they're already anemic have a significantly higher risk of bleeding complications. So this is something to think about. So what are the contraindications of some of the agents? I think we'll let Beth talk about that when she goes through the individual drugs. But Beth, let me let you, from a pharmacy standpoint, talk about something that is often asked because we spent 50 years in the warfarin era, where we knew exactly where patients were, at least on the day we tested them. We didn't know where they were between tests, but on the day we tested them, we can measure an INR and see just how anticoagulated they are. What if they're on apixaban like this patient?
Well, there's really no reliable way to measure the activity of DOAX in most of our hospitals. So it's just not something that we routinely do. Some patients will ask for that, especially if they've been on warfarin for a long time. They want to see a level. They want to know that it's working. And sometimes we would like to know if a patient is taking their DOAC. It would be nice to be able to check a level of some kind, but there's really no reliable way to do that in most hospitals.
Yeah, so particularly, you know, with this program targeting critical access hospitals, there are specific tests that can be done to measure at a point in time the intensity of anticoagulation with an anti-10A agent, which apixaban and rivaroxaban and edoxaban are. But that's different from monitoring the anticoagulation like we do with warfarin, which also serves as a compliance check. So we have to accept that as one of the limitations of DOACs, even as we say, as I mentioned a few slides back, these drugs are clearly a pharmacologic advance over warfarin. So let's briefly talk about non-pharmacologic measures, primarily for prevention of VT, not treatment. You've probably all seen the pneumo boots and these sequential pressure devices that kind of squeeze the blood out of the legs, particularly in post-operative patients, but also in ICU patients. Early ambulation after surgery, after trauma, ambulation in general, not sitting on your rear end all the time. You know, they say sitting is the new smoking. It also increases your VT risk as well. Then pain relief. If the patient is post-operative, then pain relief makes it a lot easier for that patient to start ambulating early and therefore decrease his or her risk of post-operative VTE. So there are guidelines here for the management of VTE. There are lots of them, probably the most widely recognized ones, with the exception of specifically cancer patients, come from CHEST, the American College of Chest Physicians. They publish them every 2 or 3 years. Of course, now it's going online. I'm used to thinking of the red CHEST journal cover. But they recommend DOACs over as first-line therapy over vitamin K antagonists, which is warfarin. More recently, the American Society of Hematology, or ASH guidelines, you see here on the first bullet, recommend DOACs as first line over VKA. Really, the only drawbacks are patients who have severe renal insufficiency. And we talked about patients with a prosthetic heart valve. Patients with moderate to severe liver disease are at risk with any anticoagulants, not just DOACs, but at least with warfarin, you can monitor them. So the phases of VTE treatment, I think, Beth, were you going to cover this?
So different phases of VTE, at the point of diagnosis, the patient is often in the emergency room, and this is where the provider is going to decide whether it's safe for the patient to be discharged home for outpatient therapy or if he needs to be admitted for parenteral therapy. This is the time where you evaluate your patient to see which oral agent may be the best for them. Based on their risk factors, maybe other medications that they're on. And also, this is when you would educate the patient about this therapy, how long you expect them to need to take it, and arrange quick follow-up with a primary care provider within the next week. But during the primary treatment stage, this is usually between 3 to 6 months. During this time, you need to periodically check in with your patient, as we were talking about a minute ago. Make sure that they're not having any worsening symptoms of their thromboembolism, that they're not having any signs and symptoms of bleeding or any other complications from therapy. And at the point where it's decided whether to stop the anticoagulation or continue it, this is usually done in a primary care physician office. So our primary care doctors usually make this decision based on a risk-benefit analysis, looking at the patient's continued risk for thromboembolism, as well as their risk for bleeding. Sometimes you're able to just decrease the dose of a DOAC, such as apixaban or rivaroxaban, for secondary prevention indefinitely. The American Society of Hematology guidelines did a great summary of evidence of 24 systemic reviews and 12 randomized clinical trials, including patients with symptomatic proximal DVT or pulmonary embolism. These patients were randomized to DOACs or initial treatments with a low molecular weight heparin, with dose-adjusted warfarin with INR range of 2 to 3. Dabigatran and edoxaban were given after 5 to 10 days of parenteral therapy with a low molecular weight heparin. Patients were excluded if they had a creatinine clearance less than 25 for apixaban or less than 30 for all other DOACs. And they were also excluded if they were at high risk for bleeding. These studies showed that a DOAC versus warfarin did not impact mortality or risk of PE, and the DOAC use was associated with a decreased risk of major bleeding, which is really important to note, and it's also less burdensome usually for patients. Our conventional therapy with warfarin, we know that warfarin is effective for treating VTE, and sometimes it is a preferred option for patients with severe renal or liver disease, and even those patients who have poor adherence to medication. Sometimes patients do better when they have to come into clinic to get an INR checked, their medications are reviewed, they get more counseling on the importance of compliance. So some patients do better with that. Patients with a high risk for bleeding complications, sometimes warfarin is a better choice for them because of the ease of reversal. In patients that have had highly prothrombotic states, such as antiphospholipid antibody syndrome or heparin-induced thrombocytopenia, it's better for these patients. But as we all know, it has a very narrow therapeutic index. Warfarin is hard to manage. It has a lot of drug interactions, wide dosing variabilities. There's numerous food interactions, such as with vitamin K foods, as well as high protein foods. Some fruits and juices interact with warfarin. So it does require frequent monitoring by experienced practitioners that understand these things. One thing that has been very helpful in the last several years is that more of our patients are able to get home INR meters. So Medicare covers the cost of a home INR monitor. Unfortunately, Medicaid does not right now, but most private insurances do cover the cost of it. So that's been very beneficial to some of our patients. With traditional management of DVT with warfarin, you use a parenteral anticoagulant as bridge therapy until the INR reaches its goal of 2 to 3. Duration of therapy is based on individual patient factors, such as what was the cause of their thromboembolism, as well as the risk of bleeding. So a patient is usually treated for 3 to 6 months, but if a patient has had an unprovoked DVT and they have a low to moderate bleeding risk, or if they have active cancer with their DVT, it is recommended to extend treatment for longer than 3 months. But a patient that's had a transient risk factor, they may only need about 3 months of therapy. Our direct oral anticoagulants are safe and effective treatments for VTE, and they're preferred for patients who have transportation issues and difficult venous access and other reasons where they cannot comply with INR monitoring. But it is important to monitor renal function in these patients and CBC at least annually. For those patients whose renal function fluctuates a lot, such as our advanced heart failure patients, these patients' renal function needs to be monitored more closely. For cancer-associated thrombosis, your patient needs to be able to hold down food and medication. So if they've just had some chemo and they're having a lot of nausea and vomiting, you may need to switch them to a low molecular weight heparin during that time. Be aware that there are specific dosing adjustments and drug interactions that could prohibit the use of a DOAC. So when we look at this chart, there are three oral direct factor 10A inhibitors, apixaban, rivaroxaban, and edoxaban, and one oral direct thrombin inhibitor, dabigatran, that we have available to us. With edoxaban and dabigatran, as Charlie mentioned earlier, both of these require 5 to 10 days of parenteral therapy. So this usually precludes the use of these medications in most of our patients, mainly because nobody wants to pay for two anticoagulants at first. So maybe if they were already in the hospital and had already received parenteral therapy, those might be a choice for them. But most times we use apixaban or rivaroxaban if it's initiated in the emergency room. be aware that the dosing for atrial fibrillation versus venous thromboembolism are different for these medications, and the reduction of the doses is different based on the indication. So it's important to understand these things. We don't use DOACs in any patient that has a mechanical heart valve. We avoid use in severe hepatic disease. For apixaban, the dose is 10 milligrams twice daily for the first week, and then the dose will drop to 5 milligrams twice a day. You will only reduce the dose to 2.5 twice a day if apixaban is used with combined PGP and strong 3A4 inhibitors, such as ketoconazole, itraconazole, and ritonavir. You will avoid use of apixaban with strong dual inducers of 3A4 and PGP. And these medications include rifampin, phenytoin, and carbamazepine. And that's one of the biggest things that we see as pharmacists, is that physicians sometimes forget that you should not use a DOAC when someone is on phenytoin or carbamazepine. We know that in studies, the area under the curve is significantly decreased for our DOACs, and you would only get therapeutic levels about 50% of the time if you use those drugs in combination. For rivaroxaban, 15 milligrams twice daily for the first 21 days, and then you can drop the dose to 20 milligrams daily. This does need to be taken with food. There is no reduced dose indication. You would just avoid use if the creatinine clearance is less than 15, and you would avoid use if you were using it with any combined PGP and strong 3A4 inducer or inhibitor. So there's no reduced dose indication for rivaroxaban for VTE diagnosis. Fortunately, with apixaban and rivaroxaban, there's a starter pack that includes the 10 milligrams twice daily for 7 days and 5 milligrams BID dose and the first month's dose of rivaroxaban. So it's very helpful to be able to prescribe that, because we can give a patient a free 30-day trial card and prescribe the starter pack for either apixaban or rivaroxaban, and the patient can go to the pharmacy and get that for no cost to them. So that's very helpful. There's a lot of risk and benefits, as we've already kind of discussed, of DOACs versus vitamin K antagonists. So I won't go through all of these, but obviously there's no routine monitoring with DOACs. They have a shorter half-life, which makes it advantageous for patients that need invasive procedures. So there's no need to bridge somebody for a procedure. If they're on a DOAC, you simply hold the dose 1 to 2 days, depending on their renal function and how invasive the procedure is and the risk of bleeding. Most patients find it easier to use a DOAC, and it usually is more cost effective from a health system perspective. However, there is potentially higher drug acquisition costs for patients for DOACs, and that's what we see a lot in Mississippi, is patients just aren't able to afford them. So some of the barriers and solutions that we have for optimal treatment: with the cost of DOACs, it is covered by most insurance, including Mississippi Medicaid, which is great for us. There are manufacturer patient assistance programs. Anybody can use a free 30-day trial card, even if they have insurance. There's copay cards for patients that have non-government insurance. And there's also the yearly patient assistance for qualified self-pay patients. You do need someone to handle the paperwork, so this isn't something that the emergency room will do, but the primary care office will do it, or a co-ed clinic can do this. The patient just needs to fill out an application, the doctor signs it, and the patient submits his financial records to send to the company to be approved for financial assistance, and that's very helpful for a lot of patients. Patients that have transportation issues can use mail order pharmacies or delivery pharmacies to get their medications and do telemedicine follow-up appointments. Some resources I wanted to share that are very helpful to us: eliquisformulary.com can identify your patient's insurance copay cost, and you can print a copay assistance card while they're in the hospital before discharge. The Bristol-Myers Squibb Patient Assistance Program for Eliquis can be found online. JanssenCarePath.com. You can access copay cards, Janssen Select, and Johnson & Johnson Patient Assistance for Xarelto through this one website. Janssen Select is a great program that offers assistance for Xarelto for patients that have high deductibles, even your Medicare Part D coverage gaps, so your patients that are in the donut hole, if their copays are greater than $85 a month. Lovenox Patient Assistance can be found online as well. Another thing to mention is your extra help for Medicare. That also can be accessed online. Your patient has to complete that themselves. But a lot of our patients in Mississippi qualify for extra help for Medicare, and this will decrease their copays for their medication. 340B programs, there are many federally qualified health clinics and hospitals in Mississippi that have these programs that can provide medications at discounted prices. And many of our hospitals throughout the state have access to these 340B programs. So if you do, you should contact the pharmacy and just kind of see what your pricing options are for those patients.
So again, there is an advantage to being able to measure anticoagulation intensity with an INR and know where you are at any given point in time. But the generally speaking, the advantages of DOACs outweigh that ability that we attribute to warfarin. There are people, though, who, because they started bleeding or because they need to have surgery done, may need to have their DOAC therapy temporarily interrupted. I think, Beth, you would agree that the various package inserts for the DOACs, they've been harmonized by the FDA, and so they're actually very useful tables in there that give you specific guidance on how to manage temporary interruption, and generally it's understood that bridging is not required for these patients because they're so rapidly back to blood levels once you restart them. You talked about the DOAC drug-drug interactions. Another thing that's in the package inserts but maybe would benefit from having a quick pharmacist explanation is transitioning patients between anticoagulants. So let's say that a patient changes insurance plans or gets new insurance or has a problem with one anticoagulant and you want to switch them to another, where do you go for resources on how to transition patients between different anticoagulants?
Okay, well, it does mention it in the package inserts, but generally, if you're switching from one DOAC to another one, all you have to do is just stop the first one and start the next one at the next dose. So if they were on apixaban twice a day and they were switching to Xarelto, you would stop the apixaban, that you take the last dose one night, and you can start the Xarelto the next day. If you're transitioning between warfarin and a DOAC, which we do that a lot, with rivaroxaban, you want to make sure the INR is less than 3, and then you can start the rivaroxaban. For apixaban and edoxaban and dabigatran, you want the INR less than 2, and then you can start. But there's no bridging necessary, which is good.
So let's approach our last major topic, which is strategies to improve transitions of care. Typically, what we mean by that, of course, is from the hospital back to whatever the home setting is, whether that's a transitional setting or the patient's actual home. There are multiple components of a high-quality discharge system that we can identify. Transitioning patients from hospital to home is never easy. But you see some of the issues here that are important. It's got to be consistent. It should be protocol driven. It's got to be patient-centered. And please don't forget that patients don't remember anything you tell them. You got to involve the family members and caretakers and reinforce it over and over again, because the patient's only just happy to be getting out of there. They're not really listening to what they got to do afterwards. And so medication education, follow-up education, things to watch for. Again, with anticoagulation, you've got to inform patients and their caregivers not only for worsening of the thrombosis problem, but also looking out for signs of bleeding. So it's important that they recognize the importance of continuing their anticoagulation therapy, even though it may not make them feel any better, because it is treating what is potentially a very serious condition. There's a checklist here that I won't belabor, but generally speaking, it all comes down to somebody doing some homework, and that's often going to be a pharmacist or a case manager. Physicians often either don't have or simply are unable to take the time to do this. But it's really important that you don't get too slick with this, too quickly with this, because you can prevent a lot of bad events, whether they're thrombotic events or bleeding events, simply by making sure you follow a discharge checklist to optimize that transition of care. The barriers to safe and effective anticoagulation we've talked about. They've got to understand what they're being treated for. They've got to remember it later, a couple of weeks later. And they need a scheduled follow-up appointment when they leave. Because counting on the patient to call and make an appointment after they leave the hospital is something that's not likely to work very well. So again, having a checklist where one of the things that should be checked is that the patient has a follow-up appointment in the next few days is important to do.
This patient, upon release from the hospital, did follow with her primary care physician. The DOAC was continued. Her symptoms subsequently resolved, but she was still having some issues with anemia. And her anemia was secondary to her having some dysfunctional uterine bleeding from some heavy menstrual cycles. 3 months after diagnosis of the pulmonary embolism, a VQ scan was obtained, which showed normal perfusion. And at that time, the DOAC was discontinued.
So important to remember that, that 3 to 6 month period, which can be extended in high-risk patients. Here was a good reason to stop it after 6 months. So Cynthia, you want to come back to the care transition strategies here?
So successful care transition strategies should, as providers, PAs, nurse practitioners, physicians, everybody plays a role in this part in getting the patient from hospitalization to discharge to home for a good recovery. And as we know, African Americans then sometimes do not have a favorable outcome. This slide here represents three studies that was conducted over a period of time. The first one is a retrospective chart study of a qualitative improvement intervention at a level one center for VTE prophylaxis. Racial disparities in prescription of best practice VTE prophylaxis in the pre-implementation period between Black and white patients were pretty significant, and that was because data was extracted prior to the VTE being initiated on those patients. Percentages for that, I did jot that down. For trauma patients, it was 70.1% versus 56.6%. And for the medicine patient, it was 69.5% versus 61.7%. In this level one trauma center, they implemented a mandatory computerized clinical decision support tool. In doing this, the admitting physician would be required to perform a VTE checklist and bleeding risk factors for their patient being admitted for trauma versus being admitted for medicines. It didn't matter. They just had to complete it. In completing that, the tool itself followed a evidence-based algorithm to generate a score from low to high and suggesting VTE therapy for these patients. The physician or the admitting provider, it was at his or her discretion to utilize that or use medicines if needed be. The second one is a randomized control trial of a care transition intervention program that was designed to encourage patients and their caregivers to take a more active role during care transition. This study was conducted in a nonprofit hospital with about 750 patients that was age 65 and older. And using the care transition intervention, they used an advanced practice nurse as a transition coach to kind of help transfer these patients from the hospital setting to home and for follow-up, and we'll see that on the next slide. In this study, it was determined that the intervention patients had a lower rehospitalization rate at 30 days, 8.3% versus the 11.9%, and at 90 days, 16.7% versus 22.5%, and at 180 days, it was 8.6% versus 13.9%. Also, there was a lower cost for these patients as well, about $488 at the 180 days. Also in this study, it was determined that coaching these patients and their caregiver to ensure their needs are being met helped make that transition a little bit easy and reduce the subsequent rehospitalization. The next study was a qualitative study of about 20 African Americans ranging from ages 30 to I think about 62. In this study, they looked at several different things for these patients, trying to do a peer support program with them. And in doing that, three themes came out of this program. One was healthy behaviors, two was telephone calls, and the third one was the emotional support. What this study demonstrated was that the inclusion of a culturally appropriate peer support program to complement chronic illnesses management is recommended, because sometimes patients want to know what they need to eat. Patients need to hear somebody calling and checking on them. Patients need that emotional support in order to better be able to take care of themselves. This is the slide from the previous one that I talked about using the transition coach, the advanced practice nurse in the hospital setting. So there were four pillars there: the medication self-management, patient-centered record, the follow-up, and the red flags. And as you can see to the left, we're at the stage of intervention, the goal, the hospital visit, the home visit, and the follow-up telephone calls. So basically the goal was to get the patient, inform the patient about his medications, make sure if they had any questions that can be answered. Then we would move talking about the PHR, which is the patient health record that the transition coach would do during the hospital stay, informing them on what is expected, how to use it, the purpose of it, which is to facilitate communication between the specialist and your PCP if needed. Also, the follow-up, recommending a PCP if they did not have one, or scheduling follow-up calls for the PCP, and again, discussing any symptoms, red flags, medication adverse reactions, or if your condition seems to be worse. In the home visit, we had somebody going out, reconciling the hospitalization and pre- and post-hospitalization medication lists, trying to identify any discrepancies and sometimes duplication of medications. We're going to review that with them, we're going to update that with them, and we're going to encourage them to update it as well and share it with their PCP and their specialist. Again, emphasizing the importance and need of the follow-up visits, as well as encourage them role play so they could ask questions if need be that they want to ask their PCP. And again, assess the conditions, discuss the symptoms and adverse effects of medication. Now, as far as the follow-up on the telephone calls, again, patients are going to still have questions, whether it's medicines, diagnosis, how long I need to take this medicine. Again, that's where that person comes into place in answering those questions. Again, reminding them to share that information with their PCP and their specialist, discussing their outcomes if they had any with them. Again, providing advocacy and getting an appointment if necessary, because sometimes, especially elderly people, if they call to the clinic to make an appointment and you give it to them, sometimes they forget. So sometimes the caretaker can kind of help them stay on track with that. And again, reinforcing when the PCP should be telephoned. So for transition of care for me, from a rural perspective, working in a clinic, again, I encounter all patients from all ages, race as well. What I try to do with my patients is education is a big thing for me. So once that patient has been discharged from the hospital or the emergency room and they follow up back with me, my goal is to continue educating. And sometimes with her, like I said, it was good, but I've had some that have not went so smoothly over. It requires coordination and communication among healthcare professionals to ensure optimal outcomes for the patient. Even though we're in two different settings, hospital, clinic, tertiary, whatever the case may be, it's very important that we as healthcare professionals communicate about patients that we both take care of, or that we all take care of, in order to make sure they're going to have a good outcome. It includes multiple disciplinary communication, collaboration, and coordination that enables the electronic exchange of information between healthcare providers, because that's very crucial at discharge. Now, granted that the EMR that I use is not the best, so sometimes we do a lot of faxing in between, but again, communication, collaborating, coordinating that exchange of information is very important. Again, as I said, patient education is also an important component. This is done to help the patient understand their treatment and the importance of extending long-term treatment. As we stated, some patients may be treated for 3 months, some may be for 6 months, and some may be for 9 months. Every case is different. And in talking with my patients, I try to explain that to them. if I also have the capability, this is off subject right quick, I do have the capability of having an ultrasound tech in the office with me sometimes. And if we do detect a DVT, and if we're able to initiate medications in the clinic, that's a great thing. But I also have had patients come in that presents like a PE, sent to the local ER, and it was a PE, and then had to come back and follow up with me as well. Patient education and engagement is essential to improve adherence and therapy post-discharge. Again, I cannot stress the importance of from discharge, from the hospitalization to discharge to follow-up care, following those patients throughout, making sure that they do have the appropriate medication or have access to get the medication, encouraging their caretaker, husband, wife, child, whoever's providing the care for them to take part in their care because they need to understand what's going on with them as well, being able to recognize adverse reactions from medications or when the condition has gotten worse or getting worse. Also in my practice, I also listen to my patients' concerns. I try to address all their needs as much as I can. I inquire about medical coverage. Again, someone may have Medicaid, some may have Medicare, some may not have any insurance at all and no ability to get any medicines. I want to discuss the adherence to the medications, the side effects, again, the expected length of anticoagulation therapy, their diagnosis, and again, medications and costs is very important here where I am because a lot of people don't have insurance and a lot of people don't have a job. So sometimes it's very difficult trying to get them started on a med. Barriers to care. Literacy is one for me. Again, finances because most of the people are unemployed where I work. Insurance is an issue. Transportation, especially for my elderly, if they don't drive and they require the granddaughter or the grandson or somebody to bring them to the appointment and follow up. Patient safety is the responsibility of all who deliver care, whether directly or indirectly, because we're all responsible for that patient and we want to make sure we're delivering the best appropriate care as we can. The goal is to avoid preventable poor outcomes in all patients, and especially those with multiple chronic conditions. Where I am here, we have patients with diabetes, have patients with heart disease, we have patients that's obese, being that Mississippi is one of the fattest states, and I have a lot of obese patients. So we have to take all of that in consideration as well. Again, continuing to keep the patient, the family, or the caretaker involved in every aspect of the care from hospitalization, transitioning to home and with follow-up care is very important for these patients. I also do a lot of telephone calls, as I stated earlier, to my patients, trying to answer any questions, letting the patient know that I'm available. If I need to refer a patient to a hematologist or a pulmonologist or collaborate with them, I also do that. But goal is, again, as a team, we work together to make sure the patient has the best outcome. Back to you, Dr. Charlie.
Thank you, Cynthia. I really want to thank my co-faculty tonight for such an engaging and thoughtful presentation. I think we've covered a lot. I want to try to summarize it here briefly. And thank you, audience, for your patience with this and for sticking with us. I hope you've gotten a lot out of it. I've learned a lot just listening to my co-faculty about this very important issue that affects so many of our patients and unfortunately affects Black Mississippians disproportionately. So if I were to look at a few bullet points as seen here on this slide of putting everything together that we've talked about tonight, it would be to confirm the diagnosis early, which of course requires a high index of suspicion. That's an overused term, but again, it's all about that pretest probability. You got to think about the diagnosis before you can make the diagnosis. The earlier you treat, the more likely you are to stop the propagation of clot and a DVT and improve the course of patients who've had a PE. The care plan does have to be individualized. You just heard Cynthia talking about some patients get 3 months treatment, some 6 months, some 9 months, some a year. Some patients, because of their risk factors, again, individualizing the care plan, may be on indefinite anticoagulation. Spend some time or have one of your people assign a case manager, a pharmacist of the best listeners in the world, you know, get somebody to make sure that we've assessed for potential barriers to this patient's treatment and then have a plan for it. And then you've seen that there are multiple options for treating venous thromboembolic disease. Choose the best one for that patient. Make sure it's the right dose and fits with the overall plan for the patient. I think you've heard everybody in the faculty talk tonight about the importance of patient education and making sure that patients and their caregivers and their family members understand the what they're being treated for, why they're being treated, what the potential complications of that treatment are, hint, it's bleeding, length of therapy, and then of course making sure that there's a plan for appropriate discharge, which to some extent is also based on the therapy chosen. Because as Beth told us, there's this transition point between higher dose and lower dose anticoagulation with the anti-10A DOACs, and that's got to be figured into the time of follow-up. And then again, all about communication. Just like every aspect of life, with more effective communication, you're going to have better outcomes. So thank you, all of you audience, for your dedication to working in the state of Mississippi, where we're up against so many obstacles, societal, economic, cultural. Let's all work together to try to overcome those and give our patients the best care.